mess.
The last case on today's calendar is Disabled Rights Action Committee versus Las Vegas Events. Mr. Armneck, I believe, again.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Richard Armneck, appearing on behalf of the Defendant Disabled Rights Action Committee. I request to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal argument. This case concerns the definition of a place of public accommodation as it is used in Title III of the Americans with Disabilities Act. The applicable regulation clearly defines places of public accommodation to include places of exhibition or entertainment, which are facilities that are operated by a private entity. In 2000, this Court noted that the term operates as it is used in the ADA is extensive and would include sublessees, management companies, and any other entity that owns, leases to, or operates a place of public accommodation, even if the operation is only for a short time. Your Honors, I emphasize that this Court used the subjunctive or and not the conjunctive and when describing the breadth of the term operates. And I also note that this Court was quoting verbatim from the Department of Justice's Code of Federal Regulations.
What case are you talking about now?
It was Martin versus PGA Jordan.
Martin, before I went to the Supreme Court.
Yes, Your Honor. In 2001, this Court's holding was affirmed by the United States Supreme Court on a vote of 7.
Precise issue was never litigated in either place, as I understand it.
The scope of the...
But the question of whether the PGA was operating the golf courses just seemed to be assumed. It wasn't really litigated as such.
Yes, Your Honor. It was assumed. It was necessary for the holding that was reached in both the Ninth Circuit and the Supreme Court. But
is there a difference between using the facility and operating the facility?
Yes, Your Honor. I think there would be. I'm using this facility right now. I'm not operating it. I'm here and I'm using it.
How much control did they have over the facility when they were in place?
The Las Vegas Events, Your Honor?
Yeah.
As far as the special seating arrangements, apparently, again, there's been no discovery in this case. We do know that there are special seating arrangements in both Las Vegas Events and in the state of Nevada's opposition briefs. They admit that all the seating at the ground level is taken out to make room for the horses and bulls that are part of the rodeo. Because a disproportionate amount of wheelchair accessible seating is taken out, in my client's estimation, that constitutes discrimination under the ADA.
Who actually removes the seating area for the wheelchair?
I don't know, Your Honor. No discovery was done. All we have are copies of the contracts between Las Vegas Events and the state of Nevada, or its college system.
Who sells the tickets?
I don't know, Your Honor. I know that they're difficult to get. I know that they're in big demand. The rodeo aficionados really like to go to this. But I don't know who sells the tickets. And with regard to the Martin case, the district court was plainly made aware of the Martin case and expressly said that when Judge McKibben said that in his opinion, if the Martin case involved publicly owned golf courses, for example, the university own the golf course, then this court's decision in Martin would have been reversed by the Supreme Court instead of affirmed. So I think that Judge McKibben really focused in on what's really a...
Assuming that you can only have one operator, which isn't necessarily so.
It was, yes, Your Honor, that was also that that assumption, and this is all, of course, contrary to the Code of Federal Regulations and this Court's holding in Martin, which says even for a short time, you can be an operator even if you're doing it for a short time. In addition, Las Vegas Events is clearly leasing, whether or not it's operating or not. You know, leasing is one of the specific types of activity that gets you into the operator category.
Mr. Armconnect, this is Judge Hawkins. Can you hear me?
Yes, Your Honor, I can.
What relief do you seek?
What we'd like is...
No, not what you would like, what you seek.
Your Honor, in this case, what we seek is that there be non-discriminatory changes in the seating. And the final analysis, what we would like...
Wait, but this is getting into the Rule 19 problem now. Is that... Do you need relief with regard... Is what you ultimately want is that NPR operate a non-discriminatory...
Ultimately,
so,
yes,
whether
Your Honor.
It's here or somewhere else.
That's the so that the people in wheelchairs who want to see the rodeo.
That's possible that the result of all that is there won't be an NPR in Las Vegas and nobody will get to see anything. But I assume that would still be a relief.
Well, Your Honor, my client has a lot of members in Utah as well, and those who it's a national event, Your Honor. Yeah, you're right. It might not be in Las Vegas, but in essence, even for some of the members in Las Vegas, even if they have to fly or drive to Abilene, it's can be more accessible for them by having to do the drive than in certain event in certain venues.
The practical effect of what you seek would require events like this to demand of the operator that they make the accommodations you seek, right?
Your Honor, I don't know what the practical result will be in the end.
Well, what the relief you seek is to tell the organizers of this particular event that they can't conduct it absent adequate handicapped access and other ADA compliant measures, right?
Your Honor, we'd like that, but quite frankly, I really don't know how far it can go. I don't know if there could be an affirmative duty upon the operators upon Las Vegas Events to choose an entire venue that is accessible, or in a lesser level of relief, if they can merely be enjoined from making the place less accessible.
You have a specific prayer for relief. You're asking for a permanent injunction enjoining the defendants from discriminating on the basis of disability, and specifically to cease operating the Thomas and Mack Center unless and until such facility is fully compliant with the Americans with Disabilities Act. So it seems to me what you're, at least the prayer for relief, which is I think what we're looking at for present purposes, is that they need to operate in compliance with Title III, whether in Thomas Mack or somewhere else. They can't operate a Thomas Mack except under in compliance with Title III. That's your prayer.
That was a prayer for relief, Your Honor. But in the course of litigation, we understand that the changes that are made make it less accessible, and the plaintiff would at least like to have that. At least like to have the seating that has been retrofitted into the Thomas and Mack at the ground level, not to be removed, or if it is removed, then some compensatory. Now, obviously, of course, that gets into the structural facility,
which is not subject to this act.
That's right, Your Honor.
So, is what you seek through this litigation is to force an entity not subject to the Act to comply with it?
No, Your Honor. No.
Why shouldn't I think that?
Because we know we can't get that. Obviously, the broad social goals of the Disabled Rights Action Committee is to obtain as much accessibility as possible. But you know, obviously, we can't, under Title III, effect a change. Title II is constantly being under assault, and we don't know where that will be in 3 years.
My understanding is that the Thomas and Mack Center complies with Title II. Is that right?
That's not my understanding, Your Honor. Again, no discovery's been done in this case.
Okay.
Anything further?
Mm-hmm. No, Your Honor.
Would you like to stay the rest of your time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
Rebuttal? That's fine.
May it please the Court, my name is Walter Ayers, and I represent the University and Community College System of Nevada and the State of Nevada in this particular case. I would like to have probably 7 minutes, if I could reserve the rest of the time for my colleagues.
Sir, just watch your time.
Yes, sir. With regards to this, I think the bottom line to this particular case is that if the plaintiff is given the right to exclude the state from participating in suits brought against the state in basically our renters under Title III, that's going to do a couple of things here. It's going to deny the state the right to be heard, for one thing. That's going to impair the...
Originally, this case wasn't brought against the state, and the question, the predecessor issue, is whether or not the state is a necessary party, and if so, whether they're an indispensable party.
Yes, Your Honor, and I'm getting to that. I'm trying to go to the bottom line first and go backwards. What it boils down to is it impairs the right to contract and the right to govern as a sovereign and to enter into contracts.
What happened here, as I understand, but let's take a hypothetical. Suppose somebody decides that they're going to operate a child care center, and the state regulates very closely the physical attributes of a child care a place where you can operate a child care center. So they go and they rent a building to have a child care center in, but it turns out that the person who's renting to them is not responsible. They're not running a child care center. But it turns out that this is just an illegal place to hold a child care center. So they break the lease and they leave because they can't run a child care center there. Now, obviously, the person with the lease has a cause of action for breaking the lease. But why are they – I very much doubt they would be an indispensable party in a suit regarding the validity of the child care center's operation at that place.
Well, I think that when you talk about I think they would be because it goes to the fact of the contract. They can't operate it under – it depends on whether
you – they can either fix the place up or they can leave. They have a choice. The lawsuit itself is not ordering the termination of the contract. It's simply saying – you know, either find out a way to do it legally or you can't do it here. And the lawsuit itself is not invalidating anything in the contract. I mean, there's nothing in this contract that's invalid, right?
That's correct. But I think the distinction you have to go back to is who operates, is the definition of operator.
Well, that's a different issue. You're mixing a lot of issues together. I mean, if you want to do it logically, we could start then with the question of who operates. But if we don't have the indispensable or necessary party issue unless we think in the first place that that Las Vegas Events is operating the facility. So if you want to talk about that, then talk about that. It's a different question.
Okay. Well, as far as the operation of the facility, no, they don't operate the facility because they do not retain exclusive control over that facility. They don't.
Only one person can operate a facility? Only one entity can operate a facility?
No. No, more than one can, but in this case it's a renter because if you look at the contract, they have not, Las Vegas Events does not have exclusive control over the facility. The facility the facility is controlled by the Thomas and Mack. The tickets are sold by the Thomas and Mack. The Thomas and Mack has their ushers there. They're hired by Thomas and Mack for the aid of the disabled, that type of thing. They rent the facility.
Can we tell that from the record now as it stands without any facts?
I believe there's a quote in the record in a footnote that is in there from the base core of the contract that when you look at the contract, all of the work is being done in the facility is being done by the.
Does the contract say that the university retains exclusive control?
I don't believe that that's in the actual contract itself, but when you read what is done under the contract.
Mr. Ayers, I'm losing you.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. When you look at what's identified in the contract itself as to who does what, the seating arrangements, that type of thing, they pay for us to move the seating arrangements. We do, the Thompson Act does, in fact, do that under the contract. There's also a child care facility in there that they can operate that, but they don't operate the facility itself. They don't move the seats. The seats are moved. They would direct or have us move the seats simply because they need that large area for those large animals. And it's not discriminatory to move those seats because nobody sits down there except for the cowboys that are riding those bulls. And there's no seat. Nobody can sit down there. Period. Whether it's a disabled individual or not, there's simply no discrimination on that.
Mr. Ayers?
Yes, sir.
I still don't understand how the university has a dog in this fight. You know, my understanding is just to take an analogous example, the National Football League has a phone book thick set of regulations which include handicap access if your city and your facility wants to hold the Super Bowl. And if you comply, you get to bid, and if they accept you, you get to have the Super Bowl and everything that goes with it. But that doesn't involve that necessarily the entity. If the operation of an event causes it, the facility, to no longer comply with ADA, and I think we have to assume that based on the bare complaint in front of us, you know, where's your dog in this fight?
Because what it does is subjects us to two different standards. It subjects us first to the standard.
It's not subjecting you to anything except you're going to lose a lot of business. But you're not subjected to anything.
Well, because the facility, if it complies under Title II, if it complies under Title II, which is program accessibility, we have to make it accessible to people who are disabled, whether they be disabled in wheelchairs, whether they be say orally or visually disabled. We have to make that.
If you don't comply, and if it's not compliant with Title III, then entities that are covered by Title III may not be able to hold their events in your arena. But it's not making you do anything except the economics of it might, but the statute is not.
No, it's which standard should be applied to a state facility.
And you're being responsive to what I'm saying.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Then
you're assuming that the fact that the entities that are running events in your and are, if they are in fact operating during that period, are you? They're not you. They have their own obligations, and their obligation is to operate an accessible facility.
Then it puts the state within an inconsistent obligation.
Why?
Because then we would have it, because to allow them in the facility, what we would have to do.
All right. So you don't allow them in the facility.
Then the state loses that income and it impairs our
obligation.
No, but it impairs our ability to contract, particularly when Title III clearly doesn't apply to us and Title II does. And is this?
What about my hypothetical? What about the landlord in that instance? Does that landlord have a right to rent to a facility that's not allowed to be there?
That is it a private landlord or a state landlord?
Private landlord. What difference does that make?
A private landlord doesn't, because if they lease out that entire facility.
I wasn't giving an ADA example, though. I was giving an example of these child care regulations, which do not cover the lessor. They only cover the person who's operating the child care facility.
Okay, if they only cover them in that circumstance, then I believe your assumption is
correct. It's the same thing.
No, because you're only giving one set of you're giving another set of standards there. Where here we have two sets of standards: one that applies to a sovereign, and one applies to anybody and everybody else. And I think
there's a building code that just applies if you want to have a building, and there's another one that applies if you want to have a child care center.
Yes, and why the standards are set that way, I don't know. I do know that in Nevada we've had to comply with those standards and the ADAG standards since I can't remember the date of the statute, but it's recent. And you must understand, this is likewise, I think, the purpose behind
making Title II applicable to the states is the fact they realized that there were these older facilities. This facility was built in 1983, prior to the time of the ADA. And Nevada, since at least 1973, has had to make those facilities accessible to disabled persons. And the question then becomes which set of standards apply. I mean, we recognize that our facilities have always had to be accessible. The question is which standards apply, and we've adopted the ADAG standards. And that's program accessibility for any programs that are put on in that facility, whether they be the NPO, the National Finals Rodeo, or any other persons who wish to rent that facility.
So the National Public Rodeo is entitled to come in and just remove all the seating arrangements for?
No, just the ones that interfere in the bottom part of that arena. They only remove the ones in the very bottom of the arena where the large animals perform.
To give another hypothetical, there was a case, I guess, from the District of Columbia where a theater rented a part of a federal building. Right, and the federal building was, let's say it was a state building, okay? Can that theater operate a non-accessible, a theater that is not complying with Article 3?
The distinction there, Your Honor, is the fact that in that particular facility, what happened was it was a federal facility and no stand.
Suppose it was a state. Suppose it was your building. That would be different. Suppose the state of Nevada owned the building.
Then
we have to comply with
Title II.
And so, in other words, the theater owner would be entitled to come in and operate something that is not compliant with Title III just because they chose to put it in a state building.
No, it has to comply with Title II, which is program
but
accessibility.
But not Title III, even though the operator is covered by Title III. How do they get exempt as a result of their decision to put it into that building? They don't have to put it in that building. They can put it in some other building.
They would have, if it's a private operator, if they take it to a private operator, then Title III does apply.
Right.
But in this instance, it's a Title II situation, and basically this is what we have to be sued under. And we're an indispensable party because it's going to impair our contracts.
You want to save some time for your
yes,
colleagues?
Yes, I'm sorry. If I may yield to my...
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Elena Uchaw. I'm counsel for Las Vegas Events. I perhaps go to the Fiedler case and distinguish it, which was, I believe, the District Court of Columbia case that you were just speaking about. I see several distinctions in that case from the case here. First, there was no issue there as to indispensable party about the disruption of a contract. So the case did not deal with the factual situation that we have here, in which the purpose of this suit is to disrupt a contractual agreement. DRAC has said that over and over and over again to the court. It has said its intention here is to dry up the fruits of this, of the leasing of the Thomas & Mack. Its intention here is never been to make the Thomas & Mack compliant. In Fiedler, the purpose of that suit was to make the theater compliant. If Mr. Arm Connect and DRAC had chosen to, it could have sued Thomas & Mack or UCCSN under Title II, and at the same time, in the same suit, sued LVE under Title III. And
right,
then there would have had
in,
to
would have been sovereign immunity, would have been in the same spot, but it doesn't matter because the standards are different. And you're covered by Title III, not by Title II, right?
And that is correct, Your Honor, except for that the DOJ illustrations on which DRAC relies says that when you have an operation that may be joint, and there is a specific example, the state must comply with Title II, and the private entity must comply with Title III.
Right.
That is the DOJ.
So you can comply with Title III, and if this location doesn't comply with Title III, then you can't have your event there. You have to have it somewhere else.
Except, Your Honor, that in that example, the presumption is that the state or the entity that must comply with Title II and the entity that must comply with Title III will be part of the litigation and will have an opportunity to be heard and will have an opportunity to address together whether or not there's compliance. DRAC has adamantly refused.
I assume that if the state was willing to waive their sovereign immunity with respect to Title II, we wouldn't be here.
They've never given that. They've never been given that opportunity because draft.
Not willing to waive it with respect to Title III. They invoke sovereign immunity as well as the argument that they're not covered by Title III.
Your Honor, I do not believe that what what the state said in response to the lawsuit that was filed against it by DRAC was that we're not subject to Title III, and I don't think anybody disagrees with that.
No, they're not.
Right. So, and DRAC said in response to that motion to dismiss, we will not sue them under Title II. That was DRAC's decision.
Well, isn't this all very odd? Because ordinarily, as I understand it, in a Rule 19 situation, when somebody is claiming that they have an interest in the lawsuit or when someone else is claiming it on their behalf, they don't have to have a cause of action against them. They come in as a Rule 19 defendant. It's a world of its own. In other words, they just come in for purposes of relief. And
unless they are indispensable.
Right. But the question of whether or not you can have a Title III case against the state is really an irrelevant question.
I would agree that it is the least relevant question to this dispute. The dispute is, first, whether or not LVE, whether or not Thomas and Mack should have been sued. That's LVE's position, that it cannot address, it cannot state what its obligations are. It cannot address those obligations. It cannot live up to its obligations. It may be subject to...
Let's go back to my hypothetical. I mean, if your obligation is to comply with Title III, I mean, we're now assuming away the first question in the case, i.e., whether you're operating the... But let's assume you're operating, okay? If you're operating, you have an obligation to operate under Title III. If you've contracted with a place that doesn't meet that requirement, then you need to do something else. You may owe this Thomas and Mack a ton of money for entering into a contract that you couldn't fulfill. But aside from that, I don't see what their interest is, and they're going to get that money. If you have to walk away because you're doing something illegal, suppose you contract with them to run a gambling operation, you know, and you can't do it. You're going to owe them money because you're tying up their space, but you still can't run a gambling operation.
I think this goes to the public rights exception to
No, it doesn't.
Let me try to answer your question. I think that if we contracted to do something illegal, I would agree with you. There would be no question.
When you're contracting to run something, the hypothetical here, the assumption is that you're contracting to run something under Title III is illegal. You can't do it.
I don't believe that the allegation is that we are running something that is illegal.
I know, but you are running it illegally. You are doing something that you're not allowed to do.
That we are removing, that there aren't adequate seating arrangements. This is an intermittent, short-term use of a facility, 10 days a year.
Well, then you're backing out at the other end. You're trying to back out of the and saying you're not operating, which is a different question, but it's not the indispensable.
I guess I'm saying why I think Thomas and Mack is indispensable in this case, because of the nature of the facts. In Fiedler, it was a continuous single operation where they sought compliance for the ongoing viewing of movies at a movie theater. There was no question. No one ever raised that question. And so the need for that other party wasn't apparent in that case. In this case, by the nature of the use, whether it's operation or not, requires Thomas and Mack, especially when DRAC says, we intend to sue every...
You'd rather have Thomas Mack on there because you'd rather have them fix it up than have to walk away and owe them a ton of money, but you may have to do that.
Your Honor, if that's the holding of this Court, we may have to do that. I don't disagree with that. But what I'm saying is by virtue of the nature of this contract, Thomas and Mack is indispensable. There are two court cases that have addressed this issue, one out of the Fifth Circuit and one out of the District of Colorado, where the Court has said that in order to determine operator status, you must determine the rights and obligations of the parties to the agreement. Well, in order to determine the rights and obligations of the parties to this agreement, we contend that Thomas and Mack is a party that should be part of this suit. And DRAC could have solved their problem had they sued under Title II. It is DRAC that has refused to do that, and I'll give you the two sites. It is 92F sub-second 1091. That's the District of Colorado case, and it's Dahlberg versus Avis. And 58F third 1063, Fifth Circuit case, Neff versus American Dairy Queen.
They were Neff? Did you say Neff?
Yes, Your Honor, Neff, N-E-F-F.
Can you please give those to the counsel? If they're not in your brief, would you
They are in the. They are in the record. I don't know that they are in the brief.
Why don't you, at the end of the court session today, the clerk will give you a piece of paper and just
Absolutely. And I would also distinguish this case from a case that the court decided previously where I believe Your Honor was on the panel in which the court remanded so that the party could amend their case to include a Title II claim when a Title III claim had been made, and that was Burgess versus Carmichael, and I believe Your Honor sat on that panel. In this case, Drack has repeatedly and adamantly refused to sue under Title II. It would have solved their problem.
This is really a disingenuous argument because you know they invoked their sovereign immunity. They've already done it. Why are they going to not do it with respect to Title II?
Well, this court has twice held, more than twice.
I know we have, but it's currently pending in the Supreme Court. But the question isn't who's right or who's wrong, but whether they're going to invoke it, whether Las Vegas is going to invoke it. If they want to stand up here now and tell us that they will not invoke their sovereign immunity in Title II, then we can hear the rest of your argument. But they're not going to do that, and you know they are going to invoke it. They've already invoked it. So in the lawsuit that now exists.
I think, Your Honor, that in some ways that puts the cart before the horse. And I want to make sure, since I only have 50 seconds left, that PRCA does have an opportunity to be heard. So I'm happy to answer your question if PRCA may have a minute or two. I think that it is the plaintiff's obligation to bring a suit under causes of action that allow that suit to be heard. And that if...
But in any event, they don't want to. They want the standards of Title III to apply because they say that they're subject to them.
I'm sorry? For 10 days a year. They wanted to apply without
And you can argue that that shouldn't be, and that would come out on the operating end. You'd say they were not operating. And that's a legitimate argument and one we need to solve in this case. But it's not the indispensable argument, a party argument. It's a different one.
I think they are intertwined in this case, but I would agree with you, Your Honor. Thank you. Yes.
I'll let you have a few minutes.
Elizabeth Brennan, Your Honor, on behalf of the PRCA. I have a few different comments on this issue before the court today that I think are very significant and cannot be overlooked. The first one is that the PRCA entered a stipulation with DRAC on November 29, 2001, whereby DRAC voluntarily dismissed the PRCA from this case with prejudice. If you look at the stipulation, it specifically states that it shall constitute an order which may be appealed to the Ninth Circuit. That is a final appealable order. There was never a timely filed notice of appeal from that final order. In fact, there never was any notice of appeal ever from that stipulation in order. So, as a result, this court does not have jurisdiction to reverse or deal with any issues contained in that stipulation in order, and PRCA was dismissed with prejudice from this suit.
Was there a judgment entered to that effect?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Judgment entered to that effect.
It was
earlier, at the time of the original order.
It was signed by the judge. The order was on November 29th.
Was there a 54B judgment, though, entered?
No.
All right.
So even though, Your Honor, even if you were to assume that the notice of appeal that was eventually filed over a year later in this case constitutes an appeal of that prior order, the November 29th stipulation in order, that still doesn't get dragged there because DRAC did not brief that issue in its opening brief in this case. In fact, DRAC didn't even...
They're not going to start out by saying that we don't have jurisdiction, I don't think.
No, but they should at least address somewhere in the opening brief that they are appealing the November 29, 2001 stipulation in order and or the October...
You appeal a final judgment, you can appeal all the prior orders as well.
Well, there's nothing in the opening brief that suggests that they are appealing that, and based on my understanding of the law, they have waived the right to appeal that issue, and this court doesn't have jurisdiction on it. But even if you get to the September 27th, 02 order that they did, in fact, file a notice of appeal from, the September 27, 2002 order, in that order, the judge dismissed the second amended complaint against PRCA and Las Vegas Events based on the law of the case doctrine. And that is the order that they are clearly appealing from. Nowhere in Draft's opening brief does it address the law of the case doctrine, not with respect to PRCA, not with respect to Las Vegas events. And because they have not briefed the law of the case doctrine, the case is dismissed. As to Las Vegas events and PRCA, which were the only two parties in the case at that time. So we submit that for those reasons, because it wasn't briefed ever in the original or reply brief, that Las Vegas events and PRCA should be out, and this case should be over. One more point I would like to point out is that there's no abuse of discretion here with respect to what the court did in dismissing Las Vegas events and PRCA based on the second amended complaint. And they haven't even briefed that. They were the identical allegations in the first and the second complaints. And DRAC hasn't explained to this court why this court should allow them to proceed with an amended complaint that was previously dismissed on the identical allegations, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. I'm done over your time.
I apologize.
What is it that you need to tell us?
I want to tell us that he will waive the sovereign immunity if he's suing Title II.
What do you need to tell us?
Your Honor, sovereign immunity by the Ninth Circuit and Nevada state law cannot be claimed as to Title II. Title II does apply.
Isn't the issue currently pending in the Supreme Court?
There is a case, but Nevada has adopted Title II, and so it does apply even under state law. So Title III, I claim immunity because I don't think the court has jurisdiction, and I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Reply.
Yes, Your Honors. First of all, with regard to Ms. Brennan's comments, we have no comment on the law of the case doctrine because, as Judge Paez recognizes, as this court has said before, interlocutory orders are incorporated into the final judgment on appeal. And it's those interlocutory orders and decisions that are the subject of the appeal. With regard to the Fiedler case and the distinction that Ms. Utah is drawing, and I can't really see how she can reconcile it with the Ninth Circuit's decision in Martin, which emphasizes that operation for a short time makes someone an operator.
And they decide the case in Martin. And if that's you start your brief very peculiarly with a plea that we publish this, but if you're right about Martin, there's no reason to publish it. You've already decided it.
With regard to that aspect, you're right on it, Your Honor. It has been decided. As far as what an operator is, obviously, this case involves the intertwining of a publicly owned or a governmentally owned facility and private entities that are operating it for a short period of time.
As to what operating means?
No, it doesn't, Your Honor, but it made a big impression on the district court. And as far as the district court's decision goes, they really, Judge McKinnon really is dealing with it a very broad way. By saying it's not a place of public accommodation, we're not just talking about the structure of the facility. We're talking about whether or not someone provides interpreters for the deaf. We're talking about all kinds of things related to Title III access, not just wheelchair accessibility. Of course, in this case in particular, as Judge Hawkins pointed out, the prayer for relief is pretty broad. You know, it says to stop them from operating the National Finals Rodeo at the Thomas and Mack Center. I hope that the prayer for relief, though, doesn't limit the possible forms of relief on a motion to dismiss. That would sort of be the reintroduction of form pleading.
Actually, I think that that draft is the one that's least likely to walk you into an indispensable party problem. Mm-hmm. If you start asking the state to do something, then you're going to have an indispensable party problem.
But in this case, I don't know, because there's been no discovery, I don't know who's taking the seats out. I don't know.
Yeah, I thought when you read the agreement, it seems to indicate that the state is taking the seats out.
It could be, Your Honor. I really don't know. And obviously, there's one agreement that...
Or during doing the reconfiguration. Mm-hmm.
There's one agreement that's obviously not there, and that is between the Professional Rodeo Cowboys Association and Las Vegas Events. We have no idea what their agreement says. As far as the guidance that the Department of Justice has given in this matter, I would like to emphasize Title II of the Technical Assistance Manual at 1.3000. And they say, in many situations, public entities have a close relationship to private entities that are covered by Title III, with the result that certain activities may at least indirectly affect both titles. And Illustration 1 talks about a state park that has a restaurant, privately owned, operated restaurant there. And I don't see where there is an implication that Ms. Uchaw points to that the state is a party to any kind of litigation.
Looking at the agreement, to go back to where we were before, it appears that the agreement does say that special seating changeovers, erection of stages, decorations, sound and lighting installations, and etc. are all to be done by the licensee. That's some clue. Anyway, go back. Mm-hmm.
So I just want to emphasize that the Department of Justice has spoken on this, and I don't see now, and what, of course, is a constant refrain in the appellee's arguments is that the Disabled Rights Action Committee brought this case under Title III, could have brought it under Title II. Yes, it's true. We could have brought it under Title II. At the time it was brought, the Garrett case was pending before the Supreme Court, where Title II's constitutionality was at issue. The time this was briefed, the appellees mentioned the Hazen decision, which was questioning Title II's constitutionality. And now, as Ms. Uchaw pointed out to the court in supplemental citation.
But we're told that Nevada has the same rules anyway, but I don't know how that helps, because they could still invoke sovereign immunity. If you brought a pension claim, they could still invoke sovereign immunity, presumably. I don't know if that's true or not.
I know that there's a Nevada statute that deals with structural accommodations, and it doesn't...
But is your problem fear of sovereign immunity, or is it that the standards are different? Are the standards different in any relevant way that matters here?
They're both of concern, Your Honor.
Are the standards different in any relevant way that matters here?
Mr. Eric pointed out, it's program accessibility. Accessibility is the standard for Title II. It's kind of hazy. There's a lot of leeway that's given to you know what they're trying to do, and it respects the federalism concerns and all that the Congress saw when it enacted the ADA back in 1990. So yes, there is a distinction. Mr. Ayers is correct there. That Title III is more stringent.
In some way that matters in this case?
In some way that matters in this case. I think so, because if someone were to be renting or leasing a facility that is privately owned, then under Title III there would be a higher standard of access required than under Title II. So yes, that's as far as physical access goes. If there are no further questions, Your Honor?
No. Thank you so much. We appreciate your arguments today. We submit the case on the now, and we stand adjourned for the week. Thank you very much.